It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
On April 27, 2017, Agher Hassan and his girlfriend Melinda Vasili got together one last time to discuss their breakup at her home in Kitchener, Ontario. When her roommate got home, she found Melinda in a pool of blood, having been brutally stabbed no less than 47 times. Surprisingly, Agher fled to the United States and hatched a plan to assist the U.S. in the war on terror in exchange for the U.S. not deporting him. Eventually, thanks to my guest today, Agher was caught, but not for any reason you could possibly imagine. I'm Chris Gotzik, and this is Chasing Evil. Let me welcome Mike Barron, Deputy U.S. Marshal in the International Operations Division, a country advisor to Canada. Welcome, Mike.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Jeremiah Brady was a brand new U.S. Secret Service agent at the time. I believe it was his third day on the job in 2017. Welcome.
Welcome, Chris. Thanks for having me today.
I thought we'd start off with a timeline of Melinda and Agher's relationship so you kind of get an understanding of how this thing progressed. In February 2017, Melinda and Agher got together and she was going to break up with him. But they ended up talking and rekindling on Valentine's Day. On April 3rd, 2017, Melinda broke up with Agher over text, saying the relationship hadn't been the same since they got back together in February. She said, "I'm just not happy anymore. And we both know it's just not meant to be." That night, Agher drove to her apartment, broke through a screen door, and assaulted her roommate and her brother. He took the roommate's head and smashed it against a doorframe and assaulted the brother and kicked him and punched him multiple times in the face. The cops got there and arrested him. And as part of his release, they said, "Look, you can't go into the area and you can't have communication with Melinda, her roommate, or the roommate's brother." During the next couple of weeks, Agher sent more than 60 texts to Melinda, most of which went unanswered. On April 27th, Melinda wasn't feeling well, but she did agree to talk to Agher to give him closure on their relationship. He arrived at her apartment. She said, "Just wait outside until her roommate and her brother left." He went in. They talked for a while. The roommate and her brother came back and then left around 1:45 in the morning to get some food. They asked Melinda if she wanted anything. She said no. He's about to leave. They asked her if she was okay, and she said yes. So they left. A little later, Melinda walked Agher out to his car. And at one point, she backed away from him into the street. And then she went back into the apartment. This was caught on surveillance tape. He hesitated and then followed her back into the apartment. When the roommate and her brother got home at 3 a.m., they found Melinda. Agher had stabbed Melinda 47 times, including 27 times in the neck, 6 to her chest, 6 to her right arm, 4 to her left, 3 to her back, and 1 in her face. And I mention the details just so you know the brutality of this act. And it wasn't with one knife. It was with 2. And the first knife, he stabbed her so forcefully, he bent it. And he stopped. And he got another knife. And he continued to stab her. That's the person we're looking for. Ruthless. At 2:01 a.m., Agher is caught on surveillance tape running from Melinda's apartment building and fleeing the scene in a Honda. At 2:40, police, fire, and the paramedics receive a 911 call. And at 3:05 a.m., Melinda Vasili was pronounced dead. At 3:39 a.m., this ruthless killer texted Melinda's phone saying, "Nice to see you tonight. Glad we work things out. You better have deleted that effing douchebag, LOL. Anyways, see you soon." Clearly, this is an attempt to throw law enforcement off. At 5:44 a.m., Agher Hassan crossed the border into the U.S. via the Peace Bridge in Buffalo. And that's where we'll bring in the U.S. Marshals. Mike Barron, tell me how you came into this.
We got involved in this case in mid-May, May 19th of 2017, after the Waterloo Police Department identified Agher Hassan as their suspect. And because of some historical family relationships that he had in the States, the Waterloo Police Department, Detective Jesse Kingscote, had reached out to one of the smaller police departments in Texas looking for some assistance. No real direct idea that he was there. They just wanted some things explored. Mm-hmm. And that police department then got in touch with my office just through our relationships that we have with a variety of agencies and the mission that we're responsible for. It came to us that way.
How often does that happen, that somebody flees from Canada into the U.S.? Because we've heard about it multiple times the other way, but I've never really heard about anyone coming into the U.S.
It certainly happens. I mean, if I had to put a rough estimate on it, I would say probably, 30% are Canadians coming to the U.S., where I see about 70% going to Canada. Uh-huh. So definitely a smaller percentage, but still enough to keep us busy.
So you hear the name Agher Hassan.
Yeah, so this case is completely new to me. It comes to my desk. And, at this point now, we're just kind of going through the realms of just learning a little bit about the case, identifying what needs to be done in the U.S., and then, of course, identifying what our authority may or may not be to take action upon it. And it's sort of a tricky situation because although a subject may be wanted in Canada, if we locate them in the U.S., there's no authority to proceed. It becomes sort of, complicated, like that. What comes first, the chicken or the egg? You want to find the person, but you need a proper authority to be able to arrest them. But you can't always get that authority until you find them. So it's kind of a unique situation to be in it. And it's very delicate on how we have to handle these things. But, at this time, it was just preliminary. We were doing some research in Texas, just trying to rule out any possibility that he might be there and then proceed, forward.
How do you get that authority? Who does it come from?
It's a great question. And, essentially, if we can identify that someone is in the United States and they're wanted in a foreign country, in this case, Canada, that country that has your authority over the case, which Canada would be in this circumstance, they have to be willing to submit an extradition request to the United States. So if they're not willing to move forward with that extradition request, there's nothing we can do about it. In this case, they were committed to submitting that extradition request to the United States. And usually you have to definitively know where a person is before we can process that extradition request.
How can that possibly be? How can it be that you have to know his location or her location before they can submit that request?
So in this case, there was a submission made from Canada to our Department of Justice. And we're trying to figure out and identify, one, is he in the U.S.? And then two, if he is in the U.S., where is he in the U.S.? So the Department of Justice would then send that request after it's been vetted and assurances have been made that it conforms to the treaty between the two countries. They'll send that request to the federal district where we believe the subject may be, right? And then from that point, a U.S. attorney in that district, in this case, it would be South Texas, will go before the court with this request and seek an arrest warrant under a specific statute of the United States Code authorizing the arrest based on a foreign extradition request.
But this, you're looking for a brutal killer. This doesn't sound like it happens in 4 minutes or less.
It definitely doesn't. In this case, because we didn't know where he was in the U.S. and he was a violent fugitive, and we knew definitively he was in the United States, we got an arrest warrant for his arrest based on the extradition request from Canada.
Okay.
We got the U.S. warrant out of the district court in the District of Columbia, which I think is fairly standard just because we don't know where geographically he may be. There's some complexities that come down, although it's a federal arrest warrant and it's a, it covets the United States. Yeah. There are some complexities on if he's located in a different federal district, there are some legal filings behind the scenes that has to get done. But yes, it is a complicated process. And, it starts with Canada making that request. It comes to the Department of Justice. They're going to review it. They're going to vet it. They're going to make sure that everything meets the standards that it needs to meet. And then they're going to push that out to a U.S. attorney's office. Most U.S. attorney's office have international coordinators in their respective office that are familiar with the international process. With the guidance of the Department of Justice, they're going to go before either magistrate or a district court judge and file a criminal complaint to obtain a U.S.-based federal arrest warrant.
Right.
Calling all lovers of mystery. Prepare to don your detective hat in June's Journey, a free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. Take a trip in time to the glitzy 20s and play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. The thrill is endless, with new chapters added weekly, allowing you to not only enjoy the detective adventure, but also to personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island, where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
And you said they have to submit the extradition request. How often do countries not submit an extradition request?
You got to balance out the strength of your case. I'm sure there's a cost component, especially with some other countries out there. Risk versus reward. There's criminality aspects, right? If another country has a specific charge that we don't recognize, that may not be accepted, and likewise the other way. So there's definitely a lot of complexities that go into dual criminality. So no, not every charge is going to rise to the level of an extradition request.
Right. So Agar Hassan was in the U.S. legally.
Yeah. So he crossed into the United States legally through a port of entry, a land border crossing in, I believe, Buffalo, New York, and entered the U.S. legally. U.S. authorities were not aware that he was at that time a suspect in this brutal murder.
And what about the infamous Red Notice that we've heard so much about, that Ryan Reynolds starred in a movie called Red Notice? What's a Red Notice, and was one issued? And is it a kill on sight type of situation?
Certainly not a kill on sight. And with movies, things are always amplified to a degree. In this case, there was a Red Notice issued, and essentially that's a filing or a submission made to Interpol. Which they have a worldwide reach. I think they partner with 192 countries around the globe. And essentially, you're submitting a request to their system to be shared amongst their partner countries, saying, this guy's wanted for murder. We want him back. If encountered, please arrest, and we will follow up with an extradition request. In this case, Canada did submit a Red Notice to Interpol for Hassan.
Okay. So does that mean if he gets arrested by some local law enforcement anywhere in the country, that would pop up if they ran his name?
So I should clarify, in the U.S., we are not authorized to arrest on a Red Notice. So even if there's an entry made and this Red Notice populates and you have contact with an individual with a Red Notice, there's still no authority to arrest. I mean, obviously, there's an aspect of knowing who you're interacting with and being able to report back to the foreign country that made that submission. Right. But there is no authority to arrest on a Red Notice in the U.S. that I'm aware of.
Wow. All right. It just sounds like there's a lot of ways for a fugitive to slip through.
I mean, I think there's also a lot of tools that can be utilized. Right. And a Red Notice is a very valuable tool in a lot of aspects. But there's still a judicial process that a foreign country has to go through in order to make sure that we're operating under a base standard. Right. Not every country is going to be the same on what their standards are and what their expectations are and what their burden of proofs are. So on the U.S., we want to preserve sort of our judicial system and make sure that if we are going to authorize the arrest of somebody from a foreign country, we want to make sure that, it meets a burden.
Right. Okay. That's fair enough. All right. So take us back onto the trail of Agar.
So we ruled out some family ties in the greater Houston area of Texas. Not necessarily ruled out, but, we explored them and nothing really generated. We didn't come in contact with him. We didn't locate him. We did a variety of things and had some tips that had come in across the way. I think, throughout this case, we explored tips in Tennessee and Florida and Texas and Georgia. We also pushed information to Mexico, obviously just thinking that maybe the U.S. was a transit point for him. Maybe he's going from Canada to the U.S. to Mexico or to South America or Central America. So, there was notifications made just to kind of cover our bases there. But we were definitely scouring sort of the South and the Southeast. As we started looking for Agar and we got this request from Waterloo, we did locate video surveillance of him stealing a license plate in Pennsylvania. Interestingly enough, he stole a license plate from, I think at the time it was a law enforcement official personal vehicle. I don't know if it was a chief of police or a deputy sheriff.
Right.
But he stole a license plate from a vehicle, presumably to put on his car, right, to mask his vehicle's identity so he could safely travel for a short duration wherever he wanted to go. So we sort of, you know, followed him from Buffalo to Pennsylvania, and we saw this progression going south. You know, we received a tip or two in Georgia, and obviously with ties to Texas, it sort of made sense that he was potentially heading that way. Our big sort of tipping point came at the end of May. I think it was around or on May 26th. I received communication from an FBI chief assigned to their cyber division, who was assigned to the CIA at the time, sort of out of the blue, right? No communications with the FBI or CIA at this time. Just kind of a cold call, and mentioned that they had received a tip submission on their tip line from a subject identifying himself as Agar Hassan. There was some mention about him being wanted for a murder in Canada. I don't think the details really were overly specific.
Okay.
But he mentions that you know, he's in the U.S. and he wants to help the war on terror, the global war on terror, and sort of try to eradicate ISIS and be an agent for the CIA.
Okay, how long have you been doing this?
Oh, a long time.
Okay,
over 20 years.
Getting a call from the CIA, this got to be a first. I mean, how many times does somebody reach out to the CIA and say, hey, I'm here to help?
It certainly raised some eyebrows hearing the backstory of this is someone who's calling from the CIA, who's assigned to the CIA, and they receive this this tip submission.
He puts it right out there. There's no beating around the bush. There's no camouflaging what he's done. He's like, look, this is me. This is what I've done. But I can help you with the war on terror. And perhaps that's a little bit more important than what I've done. If you don't send me back to Canada.
Correct. Right. Right. Essentially that. I'll help you if you help me.
Right. Now, he's a smart guy. So how many times in your career have you ever heard of the CIA or the United States shielding somebody from prosecution of a murder, especially in Canada? That would seem to be a non-starter.
Yeah. I mean, again, I don't know how different agencies, especially with the CIA, I don't know how they operate, but certainly.
You've just introduced a real conspiracy theory just by your. I'm not sure. So everybody's now going to be talking like, well, okay, he didn't say no. So, all right.
No, I mean, I certainly don't have, an overall knowledge of what, if anything, the CIA does. I know in this circumstance, I think they sort of looked at the totality of the circumstances and vetted this tip coming in and determined that it might have been better suited for the U.S. Marshals to handle. And fortunately enough, in the age of information sharing, they were willing to share this information with us, which was critical to us because it opened the door for us to attempt to locate.
So this extraordinary opportunity presents itself. What do you decide to do with that?
Oh, I mean, my eyes lit up. I was ready to go, ready to jump on this. And, you know, my wheels are spinning, thinking about how I can sort of utilize this and exploit sort of the information that we have now. Because, again, we want to take information and find him.
Right.
But as you can imagine, there's some sensitivities to it. So right off the bat, I have to make sure that whatever I do in the United States, one, I want to make sure everything I do is legal and lawful, of course.
Right.
But second to that, I want to make sure that whatever I do in the United States in the way of locating Agar doesn't jeopardize anything with the extradition or anything with his criminal prosecution in Canada. Because you never know. Every country has different laws on what you can and can't do.
Okay.
I have my internal controls that I have to, you know, make sure that I conform to. But I also wanted to make sure that we're not jeopardizing anything on the backside.
Right. So it is worth saying at this point that not only is he a Canadian citizen, but he is an Iraqi national. Maybe there is a link.
Very well could be. I mean, that's certainly a very valid point. He certainly is well traveled and is fluent, not just in English, but also fluent in Kurdish.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly not far-fetched to think that what he's putting out there may be useful.
Chris, that just brings me back to the point when you asked that question about, you know, when do you hear about the CIA like harboring murderers and, you know, letting them stay for help? Maybe that's his point. Like, you don't hear about it, but would you expect to hear about it?
Right.
I mean, if we're in the middle of a global war on terrorism, and this guy has Iraqi nationality and speaks Kurdish and is going to help us in the war on terrorism, would you expect to hear about that, that the CIA is going to, you know, pardon guys? So to me, that would be in this realm of secret stuff that you wouldn't right. even expect to hear about. So maybe that's,
I just don't want, I don't want to speak for the CIA and say that they will do it or they won't do it. You know what I mean?
Oh, sure.
Right. You've just ignited a conspiracy worthy of the JFK discussion, but that's okay.
Well, I mean, clearly in this case, you know, they vetted whatever they needed to vet and realized that this was nothing they wanted to. This wasn't going anywhere.
Right.
You know, at some point, the CIA, you know, received this tip, vets this tip, vets him, and determines that it's not a viable way to progress. But seeing the backstory of him being wanted in Canada and knowing what we do, had sent the information over to us for information sharing.
So this once in a career extraordinary opportunity presents itself to you, what's your next move?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You know, I was thinking, you know, again, thinking outside the box, trying to figure out how can we utilize this communication in furtherance of locating him. So right off the bat, I want to respond, right? I want to respond to him and try to draw him in. But I have to get kind of creative, right? I can't just say, I work for the U.S. Marshals Service. We want to arrest you. He set the wheels in motion. I want to spin off of that, right? But I also don't want to push him away. So right off the bat, I'm thinking, all right, I want to communicate with him. I want to respond to him. And eventually the ultimate goal would be to meet, right? But that's down the road. I got to build trust. I got to build a rapport. Right. I got to make sure that I don't do or say anything that, you know, scares him off.
Okay. So you've got to keep him dangling on that hook before you reel him in.
And I want to put enough information out there to draw his interest. So he's the one pushing it forward, and through the dialogue, have him think that he's making the decision to meet.
How often are you talking to him, and does he end up providing any information that's worthwhile to anyone?
It's kind of wild. I think we talked probably, you know, probably once a day, one communication a day for almost three weeks. So, you know, quite a bit of communication. My communications to him had to be very well scripted. You know, it had to seem genuine. It had to seem sort of him leading the conversation about certain topics. I couldn't open up doors, right, and be like, hey, when do you want to meet, right? I have to let him sort of feel comfortable and mention it. I mean, I think we talked probably, you know, if I had to estimate, maybe 15 times via email correspondence. Through those course of conversations that we had, he's not providing anything sensitive in nature about terrorism. He's just saying that he has information to share and he wanted assurances. He wanted 100% assurances that he would not be targeted or arrested for his crimes in Canada if he was going to provide assistance, essentially, on the global war on terrorism. But it got to a point where he wanted a written agreement. He wanted a written agreement outlining sort of a contract. So now we get into that same conversation with the same entities of, hey, can I create a contract? FBI, are you okay with it? Waterloo Police, are you okay with it? DOJ, are you okay with it? U.S. Marshals, you know, legal, are you okay with it? Of course, now it becomes, what can I put in there? What can I not put in there? He wanted certain language that we had a strike, but then again, finding ways to tell him why we're not adding something or why we are adding something and getting him on board. I mean,
it added an air of legitimacy that you were striking certain things or saying you couldn't put certain things in there, as opposed to just putting everything in there and Bob's your uncle, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, right. And being open with him, saying, hey, I have to get approvals. You know, I have to, you know, I can't just sign off on this. And again, that benefited us, because if I just said, sure, no problem, and I sent him a contract, does that look legit? Right. I mean, so I think almost by me saying, hey, I need to get hierarchy approval for this, because we are writing a substantial contract. I need to get, you know, internal and external approvals for this. And I think that added legitimacy to it for sure.
Did anyone have an issue of you using legitimate letterhead?
Yes, I think we did. We had to get creative with that as well, right? Uh-huh. What to use? What can you portray? Can I so essentially, we got creative.
There's a lot of work going into this, which will, lead us up to the next part of the story, but you are working on this.
Yeah, I mean, behind the scenes, there's a lot going on and people's minds are just exploding, right? I'm in the business of locating and finding people, and I want to use what I can to do that, right? I want to, exploit information. So portraying that to somebody who maybe isn't in that business, but is on the legal side of the house, they're looking at it from a completely different spectrum, and that's good, right?
Yeah, so as we work through, the voluminous approvals of what I'm looking to do with this contract, again, the ultimate goal is to sit down with him and meet him.
Right.
We jump through these navigations. We get the approvals. We draft up a contract. This contract is sent to him. He reviews it. And again, the wording is very, very specific. But essentially, he was still a little hesitant to meet and wouldn't tell us where he was going to be.
Right.
So we had to kind of come up with a plan to be able to move quickly if he was ready to meet. But again, the U.S. is a large area.
Right.
So we went back to him and said, hey, once this contract is signed and we meet, just give me a rough geographical region of where you'd like that to be. We'll set up an informal meeting. We'll vet you and your information. We'll part ways. And then if you're a candidate for what we're looking for, we'll then, fly you down to D.C., and go through what we need to on the terrorist front, of course.
Right.
We're still talking in that realm. So he had mentioned that he was in the larger, Houston, San Antonio region, and he'd be willing to meet somewhere in that region at his choice. And of course, that's still a large region. So I had to reach out to my offices in those regions and sort of prep them and have them being ready to go.
Ramp up for this operation. Okay. Right.
So
all right. Again, more people
on
standby. People have got to get ready to go. This is, you've gotten all the approvals. This has just been a huge operation.
Yeah, it's been wild. It's been a wild ride. I mean, I think over a month, we were communicating with him and luring him in without scaring him away while getting legal approval on every step of the way.
Right. And did you come up with a date that you were going to meet?
Yeah. So, eventually, right, we get to terms of this agreement and we set up a place to meet. And it turns out we're going to meet in Houston. And so we set this date for July 12th. And at this point, it's only like, 2 or 3 days out. Now I have to scramble, right, and get people ready to roll.
The trap is ready to be sprung. And this is the result of a lot of hours and hard work. And we'll just put a pin in that and turn for a very unlikely, unanticipated series of events to a very new Secret Service agent named Jeremiah Brady, who's in the San Antonio office on his third day.
Yeah. So in the field office and the morning of July 11th, a duty call comes into the office. And I said, oh, I'll take it. What a great way for me to start. And so I take this duty call, third day, my partner's sitting next to me just to
probably just to make sure you didn't screw it up.
Right. Yeah. He's making sure I don't screw this up because I'm just a little rookie guy.
Right.
So the call comes in and it's this guy. He says, hey, I'm calling to report that my roommate told me a couple days ago that he ordered some counterfeit currency online and I thought he was just, joking or full of it. I didn't really believe him. But he got this envelope in the mail and he pulled it out, showed me this counterfeit, like this fake money, and he's out spending it right now.
And this is a dark web purchase.
He didn't know it was dark web. He just knew he purchased it online.
Right, right.
He's telling me he bought this online and it came in the mail to his surprise that it looked like real money and he's out spending it right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I ask him, what's your roommate's name? And he says, well, I don't know his full name. I only know his first name. And it's Edgar. And he's like, that's all I know. And so I'm trying to talk to him. I said, well, he's your roommate. You don't know his full name. He said, no. And he starts to explain a little more detail of why that is. Because it's a two-bedroom apartment, and there's like eight guys living in this apartment.
Okay.
They all just pay like $200 a month to basically rent bed space. And he said, so there's a lot of people here, and I've only lived here for, you know, like 2 months. And so I don't really know him that well. He's just on the bottom bunk, and I'm on the top bunk. And, so, and I asked him, well, is there any other mail there that's addressed to him that you could, you know, give me the address? How about the one that the counterfeit came in? Can you look at that? He's like, yeah, it doesn't have his name on it. It's just some fake name. He's like, it's not really. All right. Well, can you get anything with any information on him? How about his vehicle? What does he drive? And he says, oh, you know what? I've got a picture from a couple days ago. We were outside grilling, and there's a picture of me, but I'm standing in front of his car. So he emails my partner while I'm on the phone with him a picture of himself, but standing in front of Ager's car. So we look at it. It's a Honda, and it has a Arkansas license plate. So my partner goes to run the plate to see, you know, what his full name is or what we might be dealing with. Mm-hmm. And the license plate comes back stolen. Now we're a little bit more intrigued.
Because normally, and I've talked to some other people in the Secret Service,
yeah,
counterfeit bills don't necessarily get you out of bed in the morning unless the guy is making them. I mean, people pass counterfeit daily.
Correct. This complaint really was sort of a small-time complaint, not something that most of us would you know, give much attention to or anything. And it was really because I was so new, looking for something to do and ways to start, that I thought, wow, this is a nice thing to start with. And sure, I'll follow this up. And you're totally right. If normally you're looking for somebody who's printing it, making it, or having large amounts of it, you know, somebody who just bought a few bills online doesn't, you know, get us urgently over there. And so the informant on the phone, he gives us the address for their apartment, and he says he's out buying the stuff right now. I said, okay, great. Hey, if anything changes or he comes back, well, we want you to let us know.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I look over at my partner. He's like, what do you want to do? I'm like, well, why don't we go up and set surveillance up? I'm all excited because I was thinking, oh, this is great. We can go do this. You know, this would be good. And he's going along with it solely because I'm brand new. And he's just like happy to see me get started. He's like, sure. Okay. We can do it. I have no idea that like they would normally never do this for something so small time that I was just, you know, doing it. So we get another Secret Service agent to come help us. We have a local San Antonio Police Department in our office. We had some detectives. And so one of the detectives comes out, and he has a uniform guy come with. And so we go out to his apartment, and we set up surveillance kind of around the apartment area. And we're set up, and I go into the manager's office and for the apartment complex and ask him, you know, who's renting this apartment? Can you give me any information? And it was basically useless. It was like, sure, this one guy, another name we had never heard of.
Right.
To their knowledge, it was just one lessee. And there was, you know, they had no idea that there were how many people staying there or what, you know, what the system was. So we're just sitting waiting. And I happen to see his car drive past the apartment complex. He didn't pull in. He drove by. And it just happened to be that he had done some shopping and was on his way to like Walmart or a different store. And he happened to just drive right by his apartments and not stop. And I happened to notice it and see him go by. So we radioed the uniformed officer and let him know that, hey, he just drove by. We just saw the car. And P.S., it has stolen license plates. Can you initiate a traffic stop? So he does. Turns his lights on. Does a traffic stop, pulls him over in a parking lot. Anger was driving, and he gets out. And so everybody's polite. He's like, what's going on? And, you know, it was a normal traffic stop. Can we see your ID? Looks like your license plate doesn't you know, come back to this car. Well, what we get is IDs. They're all Canadian.
Right.
Which totally threw me for a loop. I remember I'm day three of the office and here, you know, you hear about that occasional time you get somebody with a, you know, out of country passport or some other ID and you're right. Sort of like, okay, yeah, if that ever happens, I'm going to call somebody experienced and we'll figure out what to do. So I didn't really know. He's got a Canadian passport, Canadian IDs. And I'm like, I don't remember what to do with this.
So okay.
I had to go to my partner and I was like, hey, who do we call? How do we even look this guy up? So he said, all right, well, I'll make some phone calls. I'll try to call State Department. In the meantime, Ager gave me permission. And again, at this point, we didn't really know who he was. We just then found out his last name.
Right.
So he gives me permission to search his wallet. We find 7 counterfeit $20 notes. And while I'm sitting here talking to him about this counterfeit, he tells me, well, I've got this in my wallet, and there's more of it in my apartment. Out of the blue, discloses to me that he's working undercover with an agency and that he's an undercover informant. And he bought all of this counterfeit currency online on the dark web, website called Alpha, specifically to prove that he had this dark web knowledge and access, that he was supposed to have a meeting tomorrow to basically present his counterfeit to them and show them that he had dark web access mm-hmm. and that he could be this informant of the dark web to them.
Right. And Mike, this is true, right? You were supposed to meet him the next day.
Right. We had no idea what was going on in San Antonio at that moment. But yeah, right. Absolutely. We were supposed to meet him the next day. And, you know,
Again, when he throws me this curveball, I would be surprised if somebody was, you know, an undercover informant and he had to go buy a counterfeit to prove that he had it.
Right.
But at the same point, if there's any legitimacy to it, like, I don't want to screw anybody else's investigations up. I'm right. not trying to, like, get in the middle of things. And again, I'm new and I'm like, I don't really know the, you know, the protocol here. I don't want to step on toes.
Right.
So I go back to talk to my partner who was, you know, on the phone trying to talk to the State Department. And he turns and looks at me and says, hey, he's wanted for second degree homicide in Canada. And I'm like, what? Are you serious? He's like, yeah, we need to make some more phone calls. So I'm just talking to him and he says, hey, only talk to him about counterfeit. Just talk about the counterfeit. Don't bring up anything else. Because at this point, he's really cooperative with us. He, you know, feels like that this counterfeit isn't really a big deal. And right. that he also, you know, has told us the story that, hey, I only did this because I'm undercover and I'm supposed to turn this in. And, you know, so he doesn't really believe he's in much trouble at this point. So he's very cooperative, happy. He was just talking. And so we call HSI because
Homeland Security Investigations. Yep, because
we call Homeland Security Investigations. Okay. We call them to try to confirm, you know, kind of his status in the U.S. Is there anything in the U.S.? Because we saw that he was wanted for secondary homicide in Canada. And at this point, we weren't aware yet if there was any kind of warrant in the U.S. So I'm talking to him. We're just kind of buying time for a moment till we get it figured out. And Homeland Security comes back and says, yes, hey, we see a federal warrant in the U.S. on this person's name for Hassan for secondary homicide with extradition to Canada. And we're like, oh, okay. And they said, and we think it's with the U.S. Marshals. So in the end, I believe we make a second, another follow-up phone call to the Marshals, my partner does, and speaks with Barron to verify that this is correct, true, and this is the right status.
Okay, so Mike, you get this call, and I'm imagining you're going to say some nice things, but I'm imagining deep down you're a little pissed. Yeah, I'm imagining deep down you're not totally happy.
You know, it was again, it was like another curveball, right? I mean, it was one of those things where just completely caught off guard, not expecting it. Right? There's always a chance that someone can get picked up at any point, right?
Right.
And but certainly not expecting it, especially since we laid the groundwork to meet with him, you know, the following day. So on one hand, super surprised, caught off guard, super excited that, you know, he's in custody. Because again, there's always a chance that like he doesn't show up the next day.
Sure.
But on the other hand, a little deflated too, to be honest. right? I mean, like, just like kind of like womp, womp, womp. You know?
Right. And it had to be even more just crazy that it was the Secret Service who picked him up. It wasn't like a local traffic stop. Like, what in the world?
Yeah, absolutely wild. I mean, right, it wasn't, like you said, you know, he's not trying to cross the border. He didn't get picked up on a speeding ticket, just like through an investigation, happens to get caught. Mixed emotions, obviously, in the end, certainly, you know, safe, everything's done, happy. But yeah, then when you start to reflect, you're like a little disappointed.
Oh, sure.
Were you tempted to go, hey, I'm going to wait like two blocks away. Just right, let him go. I gotta get him so I can sleep at night. He's in custody.
We have him basically detained, and he tells us, hey, I've got more counterfeit at my apartment.
Right.
And we said, okay, if we drive to the apartment, can you get us the stuff? And, you know, at this point, we wanted to see what was there.
Right.
You know, we knew he wanted. Is there a computer that should be seized? So we take him back to his apartment in custody with us, but we drive over there. We do collect more counterfeit, and we get permission from the leasee to do an actual search of the apartment, of the whole area, which when I described eight guys living in a two-bed apartment, these were mattresses just on the floor, all over the living room, you know, like blankets over the windows. It was just a dark and smoky, dreary place in there. And Hassan's room, he was actually in one of the rooms in the bunk beds.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the informant was the guy who was on the top bunk, and right. Hassan was on the bottom bunk.
So it sounds like he paid for upgraded accommodation.
Yeah, it was at least a nicer because it was a little bit more private.
Right.
Penthouse. You get the penthouse suite.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that was kind of the first time when we got to this apartment that we met then the roommate. So as they're doing some of the searching in the room.
Did he tell you why he called?
Well, yeah, that's just what I'm about to say. As I'm talking with him and as they're searching the room, and I ask him, hey, you know, out of curiosity, why did you call to report your roommate for this counterfeit when, you know, what brought that on? And he said, well, last night I stayed up late playing the Xbox, and in their little room was a small little TV and an Xbox. And he said he stayed up all night till the wee hours of the morning playing on the Xbox. And apparently Hassan was upset about that. And so the next morning, while he was asleep, Hassan got up and poured a pitcher of water on his Xbox and fried his Xbox. He was so distraught about it that in a revenge attempt, he called the Secret Service about the counterfeit currency that he had seen. Xbox got fried.
You know what? There was a line in the sand, and ruining someone's Xbox, that's crossing it. So I get it.
The roommate was angry. He was upset because these guys didn't really have a whole lot of personal possessions with them. They sort of had like a duffel bag each of stuff. They were sort of there because they had some money with a job,
right,
or, you know, on that line between being homeless and having some work. So he had enough money he could pay $200 a month to stay in his bed, but they didn't have a lot of possessions. So this Xbox, not even the newest, you know, Xbox.
Yeah, yeah. I could see
valuable
that
to him.
Sure.
And
sure.
But that's what it was, the Xbox that
did Hassan realize that? Was he in the room when the guy told you it was because of the Xbox?
No.
So when did the bottom drop? When did he realize, you know what? This isn't about counterfeit, and I'm probably no longer an informant.
So we finished the search of the apartment, and then we basically tell him we got to go down, and we have to at least initiate the paperwork for, you know, booking you kind of for the counterfeit that we got. And, hey, if there's this other agency you're working with, like, you can work it out with them. And,
right,
and
right.
Sort of trying to appease him till
right,
we get
sure.
there and get him booked. Because at this point, he's being polite, and we don't know how violent he can be. And all
right.
we know is the history of the warrants.
Right.
We get to federal booking, and we get in there to process him. And we're doing the paperwork. He's sitting there cooperative. He doesn't really think it's a big deal. And before we're going to hand him over, we turn to walk away. We basically look at him and say, hey, and this is for a federal warrant for second degree homicide in Canada. And as soon as we say that, his face just changes to almost like eyes wide open, blank stare, doesn't say anything, just sort of like drops his jaw and looks at you with like a deer in the headlights look. Like,
right.
What? Like the whole gig is up. He didn't know that we even knew about that or that we had any clue about anything until we just tell him that that's what he's actually booked for. And we turned to walk away and he just sat there without saying a word, just looking like what just happened. Like the train just hit him. We're shaking our heads as we walk away. Like, I can't believe this day just even happened. Followed up on this small time call because it's my third day in the office. And we end up getting a guy wanted for murder in Canada. Like, it's sort of like every investigator's dream. And that's right. That once in a life case that happens where right. You hear about these stories of a traffic stop that turned into this man wanted for something. I never thought it would, you know, happen or happen so soon in a career that, you know, it was very unexpected.
Right. And Mike, did you ever speak to him after that? Or did he reach out to you thinking maybe there's a shot that I can save this? Or did he know it was a ruse?
You know, Chris, interestingly enough, I didn't correspond back with him after that, but I did receive, I think, two correspondence from him post-arrest while he was incarcerated. You know, something along the lines of still wanting to assist. And if, you know, if I could vouch for him, you know, he would still assist us with this global war on terrorism. So again, I think at that point he didn't really put the pieces together. So I didn't, you know, respond, but there was a few correspondence from him to me under those guidance of, you know, help me because I still want to help you.
And we should say that he was extradited back to Canada. He did stand trial. The defense attorney presented an alternative scenario, which was one of self-defense. And conveniently, he remembers Melinda picking up the knife, and then he blacked out or doesn't remember anything that happened after that.
Yeah, that's my understanding, Chris. He was extradited probably, you know, 8 months later back to Canada to face trial. And that's what I had read and heard, and you know, which certainly contradicts many of his postings online throughout the time he was a fugitive.
And he was sentenced to 15 years, and they petitioned for him not to be eligible for parole, so he actually has to serve the full 15 years. A really awful person, off the street, in jail. Hopefully this provides some closure for Melinda Vasily's family. Obviously, an incredible job done by the marshals, and we didn't see it coming, but by the U.S. Secret Service.
They swooped in and saved the day.
So, Mike Barron, Jeremiah Brady, thank you very much for coming and sharing this story.
Thanks for having us, Chris. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris.
You are most welcome, gentlemen. You know, I am not above begging and pleading. And this is the part where I ask you, please, to go to like Apple or Spotify and give us a 5-star review. It really helps. And it's very unusual to have a podcast where you're hearing from people in law enforcement who are still at the tip of the spear. And we're just growing this thing. So we really could use your help. And if the spirit moves you, leave us a glowing review. It really does help get the word out. So thanks very much in advance. And finally, Chasing Evil is produced with the cooperation of the United States Marshals Service. It contains interviews with current and retired employees as well as other persons. Opinions, positions, and views expressed by any of them may not reflect the official views, positions, or policies of the United States Marshals Service. Stay safe, everyone.